Now, you as a person, how do you make your money? How do you earn a living with that? People must know, but can we sort of describe and nail down what it is you've been doing for the past 30 years?
Well, it has changed. 30 years ago, what year was it 30 years ago?
81.
In 81, I was a struggling musician. I had had my first solo record deal, and I'd been playing in bands and scraping a living barely. You know, kind of like the Wright Brothers. And most of the time, I had a part-time washing up job, and that just made me enough money. And because I was house-sitting, I was never on the dole, put it that way. I have never been on the dole or claimed anything from the DHSS. So I was actually quite poor, but I knew how to live on a shoestring. And then round about the mid-80s, the early mid-80s, I started getting odd writing jobs and getting odd bits of money from music, records and things. Still not enough, so I was still washing up. And then I thought that, I think I was about 32 by this time, and I thought that this music thing may not come off, and the writing thing I was still a bit kind of a hobby. So I decided I should go to gardening, because that had been what I'd done as a kind of semi-trade when I was very young, and my granddad and my dad had brought me up, so I became a village gardener. Of course, as is the way of these things, the Zen thing, that once you stop trying for something, it comes to you. And within a month of me starting gardening, a pop star was on the phone inviting me down to a studio to help him out with his record. From that, I got another deal. So we were off on the music biz merry-go-round again with Captain Sensible. And that went on because Punk Revolution was over. And I began making records. Even then, it was fits and starts. And, you know, I'd make a chunk of money, then nothing, and then the gardening, and then gradually it seemed to dawn on me that people were offering me more and more writing. The Independent seemed to be publishing my poems. I don't know how it happened, but around about 1990 was the turning point.
And that's like a crossover from doing music to focusing much more on poetry and on...
Well, the poetry was a complete surprise, but then I started getting on the radio, and, you know, Ned Sheeran had me on Loose Ends, and I suddenly noticed from running my accounts book, which I run, and my accountant said, you're going to need to stop running 4 columns and start running 16 because the source of your income is so diverse. I was getting record royalties. And it still didn't add up to much, but then I think round about the mid-90s it suddenly did, with the Independent made an honest chap of me. And they didn't put me on contract, but I was doing 3 large pieces a week for them for some years. And they wouldn't put me on contract still, but they guaranteed my job, which enabled me to actually buy the second smallest house in the village, and which was a good thing. I suppose that would have been about 16, 17 years ago.
And also published in many different books. One of my favourite books. Can we please just retell the story? I think it's wonderful. So, in A Prospective Wivenhoe, which is really a collection, all different tales and observations. So, getting back to Captain Sensible, the night the stars stayed in. Can you recount that story for us briefly?
I can only confirm 2 of these stories, but I have no doubt that they happened. I can personally confirm 2 of them. I know another bloke who can confirm his bit as well.
So the captain was in Wivenhoe?
Yes, he came up to see me because he'd been overworking for some years, and he came up and said, look, instead of being in Brighton or London, why don't you come up to mine? Because I've got this building that I borrowed off a chap in... I was temporarily homeless, but I'd got this building where I had my studio and kept all my stuff. So we went up there with some ciders to write some songs, and he came up. But he'd been pestered in a pub by some people because, you know, he was still quite famous then. You know, he's still not very far away from Charlton Heads. So we stayed in, we just got some cider, we stayed in and we worked. Meanwhile, on Clifton Terrace, someone else, someone I know who's actually, she still lives here, but her former partner was an alcoholic, and he'd known Paul Simon when Paul Simon was hitching around the place in the 60s. Been very good friends with him, Paul Simon of Simon and Garfunkel. And that was the same. So when someone said to me, I gather we've had a rather famous person staying here, I said, how did you know that? Well, I mean, on Clifton Terrace, not it?
You're thinking the captain.
Well, you know, captain was down here with me yesterday, so now I know that Paul Simon, because he was here, he did come and see his mate. He persuaded him to go into he put up the money to put him into this thing. And while he was here, he put a hoodie on of some sort and went past a very busy Rose and Crown, out for a walk along the marshes. You can ask Chris Gilardi, if you like, he'll confirm it. He was there.
Whereas meanwhile, also, the kind of third character in the story...
Well, the third character was Van Morrison, who, a student who was staying at what was then Pam Dan's house. I don't know if Pam was there, but she called him her uncle, and I think he might have been her uncle, but he's not a very close family friend, and he's well-known, sort of taciturn, moody sort, so I think he just came... Stayed in, bought everybody a bit of dinner, bought everyone a takeaway, and then went home. And all three men were here, Sensible, Captain Sensible, and Van Morrison and Paul Simon. Within the same sort of 24 to 36 hours, none of them met, and none of their respective hosts knew.
That could have been quite some dinner party, or quite some last orders there at the Greyhound. So I think, though, in all seriousness though, Martin, so you sort of mentioned, yes, through the music and also through the poetry, but... People, I'm sure, are very, very familiar with your work, and it is very North Essex, Wivenhoe based, so you can't not live here and not be really inspired by what you see around you.
I really like it, yeah.
You kind of really write about what you see around you.
Well, I write about what I know and what I see. I don't write about what I don't know. And there's no point. Well, I don't write about my inner workings either. You know, I don't write that sort of agony parade stuff that a lot of poets do. And that's probably why I'm not... You know, the poetry establishment, if there is such a thing, I mean, we don't have much to do with each other, because I tend to think what ordinary people think. I see somebody reading into their jumper some ghastly piece of angst and just think, God, I'm not interested in that. Except I'll say it, you know, I will actually say it. People say, oh, we've got some poets coming. Not necessarily here, but, you know, we've got a really important poetry gig coming with so-and-so who was, you know, Oxford University. And I'm thinking... I will just come out and say, I'm not going and watching that. It's rubbish. I hate it. It'll be utterly wretched and miserable. You won't be able to get a drink. You'll sit there crossing your legs, wondering when the guy's going to stop. Why be hypocritical? Just don't go. And I don't. I mean, I offer people entertainment when I do poetry readings, you know.
Yeah, there's your recent performance upstairs at the Greyhound, which, yes, wasn't your traditional university-style poetry reading.
No, it's not.
And there was some exceedingly filthy jokes in there, but you seemed to please everybody. There was a mixture of...
Well, I do some serious stuff, but it's stuff about, you know, things that have gone, you know.
Yeah, so also one of your recent commissions, which people might have read, which I thought was just really quite lovely, was the poem for the Royal Wedding, which didn't at all touch upon the names of the two young folk involved. So how does it work? So when you get a phone call and someone says, can you write to us and it must start here, it must end there, it must include this?
I was plugging my guitar in the studio, trying to get a track done up at Tai Chi Dave's. And the phone rang. I said, hang on, Dave, I'll get this. So I don't usually carry my phone. And it was one of the commissioning editor at Features of The Guardian, Glenn Morley. Martin, you do a royal poem? And I said, what? After the wedding, he said. No, kind of for the Sunday after the wedding. And I said, well, that's Sunday, and here we are, it's kind of Thursday lunchtime. I said, when do you want it? He said, oh, can I need it by sort of Friday, you know, close of play. And I said,
next day.
It's Thursday lunchtime.
Yeah.
Now. And he said, well, you can do it, can't you? I said, well, I'm not really a royalist. I said, I'm not a Republican, but I'm not really a big sort of flag-waving, bunting royalist sort of thing. And I tried to pull him off. And he said, but this is a poem about love and people getting married. And I said, yeah, that's true. Well, you know, I was thinking also, God, it'd be a lot of money, and it'll annoy the Guardianistas. So that's always a benefit, I think. So I said, yeah, you know, because people say, you wrote a royal poem. I'm like, yeah. What do you expect me to do? Not write one? So, you know, I mean, it made a lot of people happy. And of course, I ended up watching some of it, didn't I, just to get some detail. So I immediately downed tools, unplugged guitar, switched recorder off, got on the bike, said, sorry, Dave, I've got to be at work. And I worked and worked and worked and worked, just writing a poem about a young couple in London getting married and about London. Skirted around everything, just left the royals, left the stuff, because it was just... And in the end, when I watched it, shortly before going to a gig, I actually thought... That was a really colourful bit of telly. What a great bit of telly that was. I really enjoyed that. It was very atmospheric. And then, of course, I got in the van and you know, to go to the gig, because we had all day and all night gig as well. So I filed the piece, and I'm thinking, oh God, this will never pass muster. And they went back and said, fabulous, Martin, what a great job. You can go have a beer now, sort of thing. And then the car outside, and I got in the wagon. I scarcely remember writing it. And when I looked back on it, I thought, you know, for a rush job, that was kind of all right. I don't know whether it would go in the, not an analogy, in an anthology. But I thought, you know, I bet, who's the poet laureate now? I bet, what's her name? Carol Ann hasn't written that. So I know her, so I meet her sometimes. I mean, I bump into them all from time to time, and they're never rude about me, well, not to my face.
Mm.
Andrew Motion always seems rather startled when he meets me. And I met Wendy Cope. I did Latitude with her under a year ago. And she was saying, oh, you're Martin Nielsen. You're much more bohemian than I thought you'd be. I said, how did you expect me to be? She said, I thought you'd have short hair and a suit. I was thinking, I wonder why.
Yeah, so there's very, very few kind of working poets, maybe that do, you know, fit your description. But one character which does spring to mind is kind of your sort of partner in crime. Again, with, I think, really quite amazing or unbelievable North Essex, Colchester, Wivenhoe connections, is John Cooper Clarke.
Oh, Johnny Clarke, yeah.
So what's the story there? How did you first meet? What on earth is he doing living around these parts? And isn't he a great character?
He fell in love with... he hasn't been around a lot lately because he's been out on tour. I mean, he's been out in Estonia and Denmark and places like that, I think. They've had him out on the road because he's clear now. So of various contractual problems he had is all I can say. He had contractual problems, and he had new management who swept in and cleared the board for him, and he's out working. I got him out working in huge places as he should be, but I'm afraid we'll probably see less of him now. How did I meet him? He was supposed to be playing at the Baker's Arms when I was just getting started, and someone said, do you want to come and support him? And he didn't turn up because he got snowed in London. It was really deep snow, and I had to walk through the snow to get to this gig. I have a habit of going through the snow to get to gigs. And I met him shortly thereafter, and he said, do you want to open for me again properly, you know? And the pub landlord was very pleased with me. And he said, you know, you did well, and you filled in for him, and, you know, you come back here as a double header. And I met John. And he does the usual thing, you know, which he says to all the girls. He just says, well, I'm not working with you again. You're too in good. But, I mean, in fact, we found we had an incredible amount in common. He'd come to Colchester a few years before, and he had fallen in love with his missus. That wasn't his missus at the time, but a very cosmopolitan, nice northern French woman called Evelyn. And he's been with her for decades. And she just happened to live in Colchester. So that's what he's doing here. And our kids have kind of grown up together, and we've been on holidays together. But if you told me back in 1979, when he first got famous, when I was, you know, not as famous as him and just getting my first record contract, that one day you will know Johnny Clarke really well, I'd have thought, well, how and why would that happen? But it did.